My name is Clancy Imislund, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very happy to be here tonight at the first annual Dick Martin Joe Leith Testimonial Banquet. Dick's stories have pretty well eaten up the time, and I want to thank you very much. But I am glad to be here. It's always a pleasure to... When I was listening to Dick talk about how wonderful this group was, I just got a surge of admiration for all of you. I'd been sitting there feeling a little bad because when I was asked to fill in for my friend Joe, I had to give up my Super Bowl ticket for tomorrow on the 35-yard line. And I was a little sullen about it, but after... Well, it's easy for you to say, go right there. It's like, it's a little more exciting than watching Nebraska play Penn State. Get him, big lad, get him. I was feeling a little uncertain, you know, a little sad about it, but when Dick was talking about what a wonderful group this was and how it made all their visitors feel warm and how magnificent you all were, I was just so proud to be here. And I there's one little part of the long form of the traditions you must read, Dick. It says, we prefer to let our friends praise us. But I'm glad to be here to see meet a number of people tonight who I've met before at the Cornhusker Roundups. And glad to see my friend Terry, the world's worst driver, who's driven here all the way from St. Joseph, Missouri at a speed of 11 miles an hour, left Tuesday. Sitting across the table from some hideous newcomer that got it. He was so new he got a book, and I tried to buy it from him and he wouldn't sell it. Somebody told him how much it cost. He knows it cost more than 35 cents that I offered him. And I'm glad to see a great many people here tonight, because any convocation of Alcoholics Anonymous is a warm, enthusiastic thing if they're gathered in the right spirit. Sometimes groups get together and they're sullen and negative, and then it's not much fun at all, but up things are fine. I want to tell Jim, he said that we both were fans of the Green Bay Packers. I was a fan of the Green Bay Packers right up till the last minute, till they lost to Dallas. Then I became a Dallas fan, actually. And then last week I became a Washington Redskins fan. And tomorrow night I'm going to be a Miami Dolphins fan. Are there any safe subjects here? Maybe I better talk about something you know nothing about. Let me discuss the steps so far. Well, is there anybody I haven't offended yet? I want to thank Dick and his wife Peg for their hospitality at their home. I was going to stay at the Holiday Inn, but they got me in at their home $5 cheaper. There's no hot water, but... I'd get in hot water then. Now, let's see. Is there anything I've forgotten? Oh, yes, one thing. I used to drink. I knew there was something I was missing in my talk tonight. I used to drink, and I drank for a number of years, as I'm sure many people in this room did. And I spent a lot of time drinking, off and on, and I never paid much attention to it, really. Because I never felt for years that drinking was ever my major problem. Sometimes it was when I got in a jackpot, when I got in trouble, I would think about my drinking and think I would have to moderate it. But I never really felt I was an alcoholic or that drinking was really my problem, because from as far back as I can remember, I always felt that my emotions must be different than other people's. Not that they were significantly different. It just, I remember thinking one time, the way to describe it is that when you come off the end of the assembly line and the last operation is, they're supposed to put on a protective coating. And when I got to the end of the assembly line, somebody said, "Hey, God," and God said, "Yeah." screw him, he's Norwegian. And it seemed that my emotions were like other people's, but I just seemed to feel things more intensely. And I based this, of course, on the classic way that people like me, and I suppose like many of you, base how you are, by comparing yourselves against other people. By comparing yourself to peers or other people or how they're looking or how they look like they're feeling. And one of the major factors in that evaluation is that you always make that comparative when you are feeling bad. When you are feeling good, you don't stop and think how you're doing, you know. But when you're feeling bad, that's when you evaluate and think and study. And so when you're feeling a little different, you're feeling not very good, and you look around you, and it can be on a job or just people going by or people in social situations or people that you know well or people that you hardly know. Every human being, I'm sure, when they feel bad, sometimes makes little evaluations, seeing how they are compared to them. And I suppose one of the reasons you do that is to find some way to feel more like them, to be less alienated. And the problem with these little evaluations is that everybody does it sometimes, but the one thing that nobody ever seems to know is that the answer you get is always wrong. It is always wrong for one reason that nobody ever thinks about. Because I am comparing my insides against other people's outsides. I am comparing my raw meat against defense mechanisms they've spent 30 years building to conceal their raw meat. So as a result, I think it's safe to anyone in here to say, the next time you start comparing yourself, I think I can guarantee you that you will never see anyone who looks as sensitive as you feel. You will never see anyone who seems to have the secret anxiety that you have. You will never see anybody who seems to be troubled by feelings of insecurity like you secretly do. You will never see anybody who seems to have the form of loneliness that you do. You know, other people are lonely when they're alone. I have a tendency to be lonely in the middle of crowds. That's unique unto me. I always knew that. You can't even talk to anybody about that, you know. How are you doing tonight? Oh, I'm lonely. How could you be lonely? Son of a bitch, you know. There are a lot of things. I've said this before, but there's a lot of things you can't talk about in life because they're not acceptable problems. Acceptable problems are heroic problems, not petty, snotty, little niggly, weak things. Yeah. I remember a lot of times sitting, or at least a few times, sitting in advertising agencies where I was supposed to be a slick writer and hip and thinking, I wonder what these pukes would do if they knew how I really felt. Yeah. What if my boss came by and said, "How you doing, Emerson?" I'd say, "Oh, I'm afraid." "What are you afraid of?" "Beats the shit out of me." Kind of a general free-fall fear. Those are not correct answers in the world. Those are not acceptable emotions. The correct answer is fine. "Doing just fine, Mr. Carlson." "Just opening this vein to get out some tired blood. My cufflink broke." "Well, goddamn it, nothing else is going right today. Why not that?" But you go through life comparing your feelings against other people, and I'll tell you one thing, you wind up, your efforts to understand why you feel different, and the more you study it, the more alienated you feel, the more different you become, the more what we call classically in alcoholism, the yes but. Someone can say, "Well, I've had that feeling," and the mind says, "Yes, but not like this, turkey." You don't say it, but you know it. So most of my adult life has been an
effort to get a to get things leveled out, to get a handle on things, to get things together. And I've tried a lot of things. I was in psychotherapy over 30 years ago. A lot of people in AA say you shouldn't go to a psychiatrist. But I tell you, in psychiatry, I discovered answers that just made me understand so much more that it was just incredible. You get to know so much, you don't even aren't even aware of the fact you're just not getting any better. At this very day, I see a psychiatrist twice a week. And some people say, if AA works all that well, why do you see a psychiatrist twice a week? And the answer is always the same, because I have told him unless he gets to those two meetings, I won't be a sponsor. That's why. I'm not putting down psychiatry at all. Psychiatry is a wonderful thing. It's just that their recovery ratio in alcoholism is something less than 0.25%. And the only sober alcoholic psychiatrists that I know of are in AA. But it's not like it should work, because you learn so much. One thing about psychoanalysis and many factors like this for people like me, it gives you reasons to lay off the guilt. It gives you hooks to hang things on. Why did you do that? Because I was hurt as a child, you son of a bitch. That's why. And it's nice to have things to blame things on. In fact, you can get into such a habit that sometimes you die from not being able to undo that sometimes. But nothing ever works. Another time I got into metaphysics. I was working three jobs at that time. I was in one of my catch-up phases. I was working days at an advertising agency. At night I was on the faculty of the University of Texas directing a grand opera in the original Italian. That's kind of fun, watching Texans try to sing Italian. And I was writing a weekly sports column for the newspaper, because I always had diversified interests. That's one of the great pleasures of having a fragmented personality. I was under a lot of pressure. I'm a Norwegian Lutheran from northern Wisconsin, and that's kind of the purity end of the religions. And I had gone bad and married this Catholic. And she was the worst kind of Catholic. She was a good Catholic. Bad Catholics you can do something with, but good Catholics, there's no doing business with them at all. I used to say to her, Charlotte, can't we use birth control in a brave new post-war world? No. I said, how about just getting something for the prevention of disease? They sell them in a machine down here at Rocky's Rockaway. No. She had the priest go over one day, and they gave me 2 hours on the rhythm system, which is the Catholic form of birth control. And I listened intently, and I just couldn't pick up the beat. I just couldn't pick up the beat. I told her, we'll have to hire Lawrence Welk to stand at the foot of our bed more. One and the two, one. So one of the problems of my life is we kept having kids. Made me just crazy after a while. That's the way it was in Texas. I had a kid. I was trying to make up for lost time because my previous job had been playing the piano in a whorehouse in San Francisco, which is a resume buster when you're an executive. And I was really going strong. And I was drinking a little too much because under a lot of pressure. And I shouldn't drink anymore. And the dean said, we understand you've been acting bizarrely in Juarez. Whenever you see people who have little thin blue lips and they say things like, no, this is for your own good, you know you're about to be screwed. And so I had to stop drinking to hold my job, at least till my wife had that baby at the time. And so I couldn't drink, and drinking to me has always been a relaxant. It's not my thing, it's just a cushion. When you take that away, I get tense and anxious and nervous because I have no relaxant. I got into metaphysics, and it really helps to get into metaphysics when you're about half crazy because you're halfway there already. And I was very intense as a personality, and I don't like to gloat or brag, but at one time, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of six people in the whole state of Texas who knew truth. That's a very heavy load to carry in Texas. It was almost a relief when they finally put me in the state insane asylum just to take the pressure off. And the nice thing about it is I was that insane asylum. I wasn't in there for drinking. I hadn't had a drink for some time. I was in there for suicide, because that's how I get when I stay sober too long. I have a tendency to get nervous. And one day my wife took all the children to church, and I just went in the garage and turned on the motor and went to sleep. And the neighbor heard the motor running and came in there, and I was dead behind the seat, and they whipped me out and beat on my chest and breathed up my nose and put me in the psych ward to examine me and determine I was a schizoid depressive, and gave me an indefinite period in the Texas State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas. Now, that's another resume buster. I thought I was depressed before. Jesus, this... it's really hard to make it when you're intermittently put upon. The only funny thing I ever thought about that whole period, I remember thinking when the doctor said, "We're afraid you're a schizoid." Part of my mind said, "Jesus, that's funny. If they only knew. If I could get my personalities down to two, I could make it." It's this group therapy where I'm alone in the car. You know. But I was in this nut house for a while. I didn't direct any grand operas in there, but I directed the Christmas pageant. When I came off Electric Shock, they allowed me to go back to my old career. And I directed this Christmas pageant about a second grade level so the whole student body could follow along. There weren't very many delicate nuances in the performance, but the director's main job was just trying to hold the three wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you could. We just want to worship our clients. And I thought I might have to be there a long time, because I had to stay there till I got well, which was a long, I might have been there now. But they put in an alcoholic program, and fortunately, because I have a tendency to drink sometimes, and people think my problem is drinking, I had been sent to AA a number of times. I've been going to AA 6 or 7 years by this time, off and on. So when I saw an alcoholic program, I pretended to be an alcoholic. And in a short time, I got an alcoholic program. I was wonderful. Everybody else was there for 30 days. They weren't home in 30 days. They were put in there by their families and were going to go home in 30 days. I was the only one in there indefinitely. So I was more responsive than they were. Old guy would give us a talk for an hour and say, "Are there any questions, boys?" Nobody had one question. How do we get out of here, "Mr. Ross, perhaps you could tell me some more about the fourth step. How do we get this garbage out of us and get this guilt on the paper and how we can begin to work towards a new life? Could you tell us some more about that, Mr. Ross?" He'd say, "Yes, I can, Clancy." And everybody else in the room would say, "Oh, shit." I wasn't trying to win them. I had to win him. It really was not a very sincere group. You sit next to somebody, "What are you going to do when you get out of here, Fred?"
"I'm going to kill that bitch."
That's kind of a... They came and went, and I stayed, and I got to be secretary of the group, and eventually I went out and gave little talks. The hospital sent me out to West Texas to give little talks with my attendants. One night I talked at Midland, and one night at Odessa. And one night at the Big Spring Town, and I gave beautiful little talks. I wasn't burdened with any sincerity. I'd give little talks like, "Friends, I'm just proud to be here tonight on behalf of my fellow patients at Big Spring State Hospital. We were people who were lost in the vast desert of alcoholism, and we We came upon the tall green hills of sobriety, but they were too steep for our weakened legs. But people such as you pointed out 12 golden steps that we could climb one after another until we could stand high atop the green hills of sobriety to find a new answer with a new God and look back to going back to our communities throughout West Texas and show others still lost the 12 steps to recovery. God bless you. Now, you can laugh. They got me out of the Texas Nut House. And the funny thing is, I never had another drink till I ran out of Thorazine. But when you run out of Thorazine, you have a tendency to get edgy a little bit. But some people were convinced I had learned my lesson. I came home. 10 seconds later, my wife was pregnant. And I got a job in Dallas, the largest advertising agency in the South. A number of people said, this kid has learned his lesson. He's been a wild one, but now he's straight. And I got a job. I was working, if you're old, you remember these ads, these old Elsie and Elmer ads for the Borden Company. And I was doing fine, except that the pressure started to mount and I was having a little more difficulty. And my drinking was a hit or miss. I was trying to just use enough to get me through the pressures. And sometimes I guessed wrong. And Dallas is full of crap heads, really, if you want to know the truth. And one morning I woke up and I was in the Phoenix, Arizona drunk tank, 1,000 miles away. And a guy had just got done kicking my front teeth out because I'd vomited on his bunk. You think that's funny? Wait till I get to the part where I die of leukemia. You'll really like that. And again, as I've said here before, but I'll say it one more time, that's one morning I was glad I'd spent several $1,000s in psychoanalysis. Because once you've been in psychoanalysis, you always have deeper insights and more understanding than people normally have. And that morning I was so sick, when I woke up, I couldn't even move my head out of the way of this guy's shoe while he kicked my teeth out. But I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. Yeah. As long as when you can understand things like that, you really got an elbow on them. Yeah. And then by that time, my wife had taken all the kids and left me, and things took a little turn for the worse. Later one morning, I found myself being 86th out of a Skid Row mission and told not to come back, and I'd been 86th. That was in Los Angeles. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. What in hell do you have to do? I've been an award-winning writer. I had my picture in the paper all over the country for this opera I directed. I have done all sorts of things. I'm in the top 2% of the intellects of the country in my evaluation. And goddammit, I am at the beck and call of every redneck puke that comes along. And I'm dying on the street. And there's... By that time, I wish I were an alcoholic. I've been going to AA for 9 years. But AA's got no answers for people who are cursed with the ability to think. Yeah. It's a great place for drinkers.
Oh, I put the plug in the jug and it just got gooder and gooder.
There's no great intellectual satisfaction in AA. I mean, when you come into a meeting finally and you may be desperate and may want to make a clean breast of things, like, I don't know if you understand this, but I'm going crazy. They have some old fool lean over and say, well, you keep coming back. Or when you may confess and say, I don't know what you do about this today, but I got $120 in hot checks out. And if I don't cover them by Monday, they're going to nail me to the wall. What'll I do? And have some guy say, well, you turn it over to your higher power, son. I tried that once. And my higher power turned over to Sheriff Peter Pitchin. That is not a viable solution in the real world. And these steps, you know, they're enough to just gag a maggot. They're nice, but they don't work for thinkers. It doesn't help me to say I'm all I'm a terrible old alcoholic, but I know I'm not. And therefore, my life's all screwed up. That isn't why my life's screwed up. My life's screwed up because I'm surrounded by idiots. I'm going to come to believe God's going to make me sane. I'm not crazy. I look crazy to crazy people. Is that my problem? Going to turn your problems over to God? Try that some morning. Here, God.
Must have didn't get outside of the gravity there.
Going to write an inventory, write down things I've spent thousands of dollars to forget. Going to write things down I wouldn't tell my psychiatrist. I never even told my psychiatrist much because I was afraid he'd reject me. I didn't. I always thought if I ever told this guy how I really feel sometimes, he'd say, get out of my office, you sick son of a bitch. So I just told him what I thought he ought to know to help me, and he couldn't. But they wanted me to write things. And I'm supposed to, you know, write things you wouldn't read, you wouldn't tell to a psychiatrist, and then read them to a plumber. That's satisfying, isn't it? Do you still like me, Fred?
Yes, I do. Well, you really hear this.
Yeah. Is it really going to help me a great deal to have some blabbermouth know that I used to be married to a sheep outside of Butte, Montana? Is that... I want to hesitate to add, that's not a part of my inventory, folks. That's what we call a figure of speech. You're going to ask God to make you perfect, get rid of all your defects of character so you can get your own little set of blue lips. Maybe go around and talk to people for their own good. Make amends to people who've been screwing me for 30 years.
Here's $10 for rejecting me that time.
More inventory in case you've been lucky enough to forget anything. Just keep digging. Then meditation, that's a great step. Meditation's a great step for suicidals. It really is. If you ever want to die quick, just sit in your closet for a couple hours in the dark and think about how things really are. Now, all of this might be, or is there some great reward at the end of it? Are you going to be given love and happiness and understanding? You're going to be allowed to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and drive across town and tell some idiot about it while he pukes on your shoes. AA is a nice place for simple people. It has no place in the life of a person who is sensitive, intelligent, got any sense. That's all. That's why people like me have to find adjunctive therapies. And it really is, it's kind of hard to find the correct adjunctive therapy. You know, it's kind of a funny thing. I spent some time in AA thinking only alcoholics look for adjunctive therapies, but the world is full of people. You know, that's why they have TA and TM and EST and primal therapy. You talk to anybody in any of these therapies, nearly anyone you talk to has been in one of the others already. They go from therapy to therapy looking for some way. But I kept thinking, if I could just get a handle on my emotions, if I could just get it together, if I could just find the place I fit, because when sometimes I do great, I'm a great 50-yard dash man. But they're not running a 50-yard dash. They're running some kind of goddamn marathon out there. But for 50 yards, I'm a great husband, father, son, worker, brilliant guy. But at 50 yards, I breast an invisible tape that nobody else feels, and I sit down to wait for the trophy, and they go by. I kept looking for... Where's the place where it's always, where it's going to be, where it's going to, what I'm looking for? All I'm looking for in the world is the wonderful place, the fun place. And I found it a number of times, that it always turns unwonderful after a while. It turns unfun. It turns grubby. And I've got to find the place where it stays good. And I couldn't find it. I was sober a great number of years before I came across evolved a great fact that I knew, I guess, all along, but I didn't put it down into a phrase. But it's just this. People who are always looking for a good place or an exciting place or a fun place are rather immature individuals. They cannot mature to the fact that no place is wonderful all the time. In fact, there's a truism that is so true that it's just dreadful, and it applies to almost everything in life. And if you can accept it, it makes life 10 times better, but you can't accept it very well. And it's just this. Nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. Nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. But children like me, you know, all I demand of a relationship is when we both reach for the salt and our fingers brush, I want to feel a spark. I don't want to have to turn around to know that she came in the room. I want to be able to feel the electricity. And no matter how much sparks you had, I'll tell you something. The day comes in every relationship where your hands reach over the salt shaker and you say, give me the goddamn salt. And a lot of people feel the relationship is over, and what they don't realize, you have just passed through the infatuation stage. But I've looked for that in my jobs. I want that wonderful place to be there. And I find it. It's exciting. There are sparks. And one day it isn't sparks anymore, I think. It's getting crappy here. And I get put upon and edgy. People, places, and things, the paint starts to peel on them. And I just, yeah. And I realize I'm being used by them. And that's why drinking was kind of a pleasure in my life. Drinking at least adds a little color when there's no color there. It gives me a little pizzazz. Gives me a little Oz. You know, I just love every once in a while seeing the Wizard of Oz. The only thing I could ever understand about Dorothy is why she would want to leave Oz and go back to Kansas, for Christ's sake. That black and white, not even black and white, sepia tone Kansas. Instead of being in Oz where the colors are, there may be a poison poppy here and there and monkeys flying, but goddammit, there's some color. There's pizzazz, a little fun. And I didn't know that alcohol had a special effect on me. I never knew that once. They used to tell me, if you're an alcoholic, they told me this 30 years ago when I was going to meetings under duress. You know, if you're an alcoholic has a special effect on your body. So you find some dummy saying, what's the special effect? Well, it sets up a terrible craving that you can't stop. And I used to go out of meetings and go to a bar and run the test. I'm going to find out once and for all if I'm an alcoholic. No craving. Thank Christ. I didn't know that alcohol had a special effect on my body, and I didn't know what it was. They said it makes you drunker than other people. I have outdrunk any number of social drinkers in my day. In fact, the worst night of the year to be out for any drinker is when? New Year's Eve. You bet your ass, Slim. Because them amateurs are out there stumbling around. They don't know how to drink. Anybody in this room has got at least 20 seconds to know when you're going to vomit. You just recognize the symptoms. Pardon me, just a minute. Anybody got a cert?
social drinkers get drunk once in a while. They don't even know what the symptoms are. You can be talking right to them. Say, how you doing today, Fred?
Well, I said to her, I said, bleh.
I would assume anyone in this room has done this time of even thinking about it. When you start to go, you just... Those idiots just fall down. They don't know how to drive. They tried driving with two R's. They never know how to drive. Maybe the great tip-off is if you're ever at a party and you where there's drinking going on, and if you're dumb, if you are, but if you are, you notice the difference between an alcoholic and a social drinker. A social drinker, once in a while, will say things like, well, Marge, I had a couple extra. You better drive home, honey. If anybody in this room ever said that, I'd be sick with mortification. The correct answer for us is, it's my goddamn car! Don't drive me on your car! Alcohol doesn't make me goofy, it makes me right. In fact, here's something I thought about this, and it's really true. Without even being aware of it, I spent my whole life thinking the real me was the personality that appeared after three drinks. When I was sober, that was not the real me. That was just some poor boob. When I was drunk, but when I had three drinks, that's the real me. Just kind of a devil-may-care, lovable old thumb-bitch. Didn't play favorites. You with anyone, Granny? Want to play shuffleboard for your daughter, Fred? If I could have held that three-drink edge, I'd have been something. But it starts to taper off when you overshoot, and it's just hideous. And so I very nearly died, and I never knew that there was an absolute pattern in my life that was absolutely clear and was delineated in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'd read that book four times over the years and never saw it once. And yet I believe it's the greatest single description of alcoholism that I know of. And it's that first two pages of chapter 3. God, that is really the story of my life and nearly everybody's life. It starts off, the great obsession of us is that somehow, someday, we will control and enjoy our drinking. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates, not up to the gates, but into the gates of insanity and death. And that is the story of my life, trying to control the effect, control it, I can't make it without it, and I can't make it really overshoot, but to control it, to find techniques. There's a funny paragraph on the next page that talks about various things people try. That's really funny, and I can't quote it, but it's drinking beer only, drinking only at home, never drinking at home, changing from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, drinking only with people, never drinking with people, taking physical exercise, reading spiritual literature, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off. You know, it says the list could be continued ad infinitum. I remember reading that a few years ago, I'd have to laugh. I had tried every one of them, except one. I had never tried not taking a trip. Because when the heat is on, I move it. Well, Charlotte, you take care of the kids and I'll send you some dough first chance I get. In fact, I sponsor a man in Los Angeles right now who left Omaha under much of those conditions, and his wife is here tonight, and son, and I have to assume they had to feel the way my wife felt time after time. I'm glad that his life is working out, and I hope your life will work out, and I hope my family's life will stay good, because these are problems that affect all of us.
in various ways. Then it says there are brief recoveries followed always by still worse relapse. And it says something to the effect that over any significant period of time, it gets worse, never better. And eventually you get to a point, and it's just such, I've read these words 1,000 times before they really jumped off the page at me. Till you get to a point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I used to think that's how drunk you got. You get to pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. But it isn't. I've come to believe that's the condition you get into when you get sober again. That's when the problem is. You know, we always talk about drunks being such suicidals, and all, many times drunks
commit suicide.
And it's an amazingly small percentage of drunken suicides are successful. And nobody knows why. My particular theory is that when you're drunk and you decide to commit suicide, it usually is to make someone sorry. And then, as you're about half gone, you suddenly realize, I'm not going to be around to see these bastards sorry. And I have received phone calls, maybe you have too, maybe made them, you know.
Hello, Clancy. I just want to say goodbye, I'm checking out. I've taken an overdose of pills, and I don't want anyone to bother me at 111 East 14th Street.
Do you know when most successful alcoholic suicides take place? Shortly after becoming sober. There are no notes. There are no big goodbyes. It's called pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Where you, if you can survive a little while, it goes away, but for a while, because you find yourself in a position where you cannot even justify it to yourself, and you got to go out there pretty soon and justify it to people upon whom your life depends. Families and employers and people to your friends, and you want to look good. You can't even find a rationale. You can't even find a hook to put it on. It takes a few days sometimes to find a hook to put it on or to arrange the facts so it doesn't look as bad to you as it did. Till it was her fault or their fault or somebody's fault. I'm in a position, unlike probably most of you here, maybe all of you, I'm in a position where I see alcoholics die almost every day. Very few people have that opportunity. And I watch people die every day, and I watch people dying every day, and I watch people struggling in this terrible destructiveness. And it's a funny thing. Monday it'll be 9 years ago that I resigned a job as a marketing director in Beverly Hills to go down and run the mission that 86'd me in 1958. I was going back and get revenge on those people. They've got me again. But, you know, that's another corollary of that same thing I said earlier. I thought, boy, I was down there. Here I was. I'd been worked my way back up laboriously through radio and television and advertising, and I was back, and my family was back, and I was living in out by the ocean in Los Angeles, and it was just great, and I found myself AA, and altered me enough so I wanted to give this up and go down and run a Skid Row mission. It's not an alcoholic treatment center. I'm not smart enough for that. It's just I don't mean that in a bad sense. I just have no training. We just feed people and bed them down. And it's a funny corollary. I see people die every day. And I'll tell you, when I first down there, there wasn't a day that I went by and didn't thank God for my sobriety, because I used to be on that street with them. But it's another corollary. Nothing is hideous after you're used to it. There are no big thing. I go to work now, I go walk by guys dying on the sidewalk, and I see them and I empathize with them a little bit. But my mind is on what has to be done there today. Everything is, once it becomes conditioned, it doesn't have strong impacts anymore. I love the ocean. That's why I never moved to the ocean, never moved on the beach. Because when you move to the beach, you lose the ocean. It becomes part of your conditioned environment. You don't see it anymore. Like when you live near mountains. God, look at those lovely mountains. After a year from now, you can say, where's the what mountains? You know, And that's the way it is most of life. But I see alcoholics die every day. It's a funny thing. Let me tell you something funny. I see alcoholics die from liver. I see alcoholics die from exposure. I see alcoholics die from falling in front of a bus and having it run over a guy's head. I see alcoholics die from all sorts of reasons. Just general debilitation. All the ambulance finds them in an alley and picks them up dead and takes them off. The one thing you hardly ever see on Skid Row, however, I do not recall ever seeing a suicide. There are no suicides on Skid Row that I know of. Suicides are people who are above Skid Row. When you're on Skid Row, you have one advantage. You no longer are pretending that you're anything other than the rotten son of a bitch you know you are. It's when you're in the world and you have to get up every morning and suck it in and pretend it's okay one more day. That's when suicide grabs, when it just can't. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's what makes it so hard for people to understand. Well, if it's doing this to you, why do you keep doing it? And I have no idea, so I tell them to shut up. Or it's because of her. Or it's because of them. Or it's because of this or that. You can make rationales, but they get tedious after a while. The one thing I never knew, it's because I suffer from an illness I never even knew. I would suppose if there's any major reason why people die from this disease, it's such a simple thing, and yet it goes on, and a number of people in this room will die from it. And that is lack of knowledge of the nature of the illness. Most everybody comes here thinking they're here to beat alcohol. And that is not necessary. Some of the more, if you're like me when I was dumber, you might think you're here to stop drinking or to get sober. Ridiculous. You're not here to get sober. If getting sober was the answer, detoxes would turn out winners. Hospitals would turn out winners. Toilet bowls would turn out winners. They talk all they want about the detox programs, but the major American detox is the toilet bowl. That's where more detoxes take place than anywhere else. There aren't very many people in this room who haven't knelt in front of the old porcelain altar in the morning, gazed into those shimmering waters, waiting for an answer to surface. Say your morning prayer. Oh, God. You hardly ever realize your body's giving you a little free detox, baby, that's all. Some days when you're sick enough, your body will detox you from both ends at once. That's very good for your body, but it's a bitch on your nerves, I'll tell you. You're called upon to make a series of split-second decisions. And every answer must be correct. There's no room for error. You guess wrong just once and you... Oh. And if you are like me, if you were fortunate enough to have some surviving loved ones staying with you till the bitter end, they stand outside the bathroom door and give you moral support. And they say, "Gun the fire, you son of a bitch! Why don't you go and shit on her floor?" It makes it hard to keep things in a spiritual balance. The hardest thing to understand here is the nature of the problem. It is not alcohol. If alcohol were my problem, I would not be here tonight. I would be somewhere else, baby, because I don't need it. I haven't had a drink since October of 1958. What do I need of this stuff? But then it turns out that it's not alcohol. It's something that sounds like alcohol, and we talk a lot about drinking. It's called alcoholism. Now you say it's a three-letter suffix that makes no difference, but that little three-letter suffix is what makes me sick and also gives me a chance to get better. And the difference is just this. It turns out that the thing that alcohol does different in me than it does in most people who drink, it isn't what it does to me at all. It's something infinitely more sly. It turns out alcohol does something for me that it doesn't do for most people. It almost instantly has the power to alter my perception of reality. It almost instantly alters my relationship to my environment. It almost instantly makes me larger and more self-contained and them smaller and less frightening. And I never had the slightest idea that it didn't happen to everybody. But that's why a few drinks makes me feel like myself. My holes are plugged. And other people don't get their holes plugged by drinking. You know, that's why drinkers wind up running with drinkers. Who wants to run with, stop after work with a new friend?
You want a drink, Frank?
Yeah, thanks.
You want another one, Frank?
No, I'm starting to feel it. When I'm in a bar at 11 o'clock at night, I want to be in there with people who understand colorful life. When someone says, "Hey, what's out of Kansas City?" I want to hear a bunch of people say, "Yeah!" I don't want to be around some little puke who says, "Why? I have to be to work at 9. What'll I tell Margaret?" "Tell Margaret to keep you home, you sick little puke." Alcohol makes the world the way I wish it could be. Now, there's nothing wrong with that except for one thing. If alcohol does this for you, there's just one slight tab. It slowly and surely erodes your ability to cope with reality. My life begins after 3 drinks. My life without 2 drinks gets worse and worse. It doesn't mean that I don't become psychotic or crazy. It's just that the negative emotions are enhanced and the positive emotions are decreased, and the anxieties and irritations and as that old commercial said, "I know relief is just a swallow away and I want to be on the straight and narrow, but God damn it, I don't want to live like this, some kind of a guy chained to a rock." And you try to do the best you can, and one day you get up and those 3 words come out that kill people like you and me, and they just say, "What's the use? Christ's sake, what's the use?" I'll watch it. I'll control it. And I fight to control it. And turns out the curse of alcoholism is not what alcohol does to you. It's the fact that sobriety eventually must always become untenable. Now, that is something I never guessed, because I thought, once I get the alcohol out of my system, I'll make a go of it, without realizing the difference between an alcohol problem and alcoholism is when you got an alcohol problem, stop drinking, you're cured. In alcoholism, when you stop drinking, you've just taken away what comfort you got. And the painful end of alcoholism is sobriety. And now drinking is doing something to me, and it's destroying me, and reality's worse. And it doesn't happen the same in different in our lives. Some people get that surge the first drink they take. Some people drink for 30 years before they get that surge. That's what they mean by crossing an invisible line. When alcohol begins to do something for you, you don't even know it, but you can see it sometimes in retrospect. Sometime during that year, maybe, you can figure it out. But that's what makes the incongruity of the Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes you see some old fool get up, and he'll say, "I drank for 35 years. And he looks accusingly at some little snot about 20 years old in the front row, as if to say, "How can you be an alcoholic, you little snot?" And what he doesn't know is the little snot is looking up and thinking, "You can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 35 years, you old son of a bitch." It doesn't make any difference how long you drank. It's when it began to do something for you, because that's the beginning of the end, Charlie. Some people are, I've seen a number of them, my sponsors, several of them. I have a friend here tonight, a periodic, who gets drunk and gets off 3 months and knows he's well and goes again and gets off 3 months and goes again. And in between, he'd swear to take a light, "I'll never drink again," and the thing would never move. Whatever it builds up and you go, you go. So, now AA is designed to do what? To make you sober? To get you shaped up? Not at all. Oddly enough, the function of Alcoholics Anonymous, on the bottom line, if you can stay here long enough to understand what the hell you're here for, but you have to do things before you understand them anyway, as this: the function of AA is to little by little break up emotional blockages that are causing you to distort your reactions to reality. To little by little alter your perception of reality. Because no matter what I tell you, if it all looks crappy to you, it's going to be crappy. If something doesn't change, you know, that's one of the interesting things that AA seems so... But how do you do it?
Well, never mind. Just do it.
Today, there's a great school of thought about treatment centers. When I got sober, there weren't very many treatment centers. And we were trained to dislike them. And I spent a lot of years disliking treatment centers. All treatment centers. Over the years, however, I've come to be a little tolerant. I now like some treatment centers, and I don't like some intensely. And you say to people, why would you want to go to a treatment center when you can come to Alcoholics Anonymous and get it for nothing? You know, you just want to shake them. And we forget what it's like, you know. As I think about this, if I were on the beach in Santa Monica tonight, and I wanted to go to Catalina, which is an island out of sight, and there was a small ferry there called the SS Treatment Center, with people with coffee and food and attendance, and we'll take you. And you say, okay, what's the other deal? And here are two guys skulking down the beach saying, we've got an invisible boat. You want to go with us? Not me, Jim. Anybody in their right mind that had a choice and insurance would go on that treatment center boat. I don't put them down at all for it. The only problem with the treatment center is this. You get out, just out of sight of land, and they say, well, we're turning back now. But I'm not there yet. Just swim like hell. Remember the comfort you had here. And you start swimming. And here come these two pukes in their invisible boat. You want to ride in my invisible boat?
I ain't that sick, Jim.
And you almost drowned, and here they come again.
Want to ride in our boat?
You get in, and as soon as you dry off, you think, this is ridiculous. There's no boat here. Some sort of optical illusion. What do I do?
Better grab an oar and row.
Get the row off. This is nonsense. And I would dive back in. Eventually they come by one more time.
All right. Better grab an oar and row.
You crazy bastards. And the irony is, the boat only appears after you begin to row. But no one wants to row a boat until they can see it. Which makes a paradox. You have to be kind of desperate sometimes to pick up that goddamn oar when there ain't no oar. And the boat appears. And if you row long enough, the boat gets better and better and better. You wonder what you ever saw in that. Young man, cream and sugar in mine. Sorry, kid. When I was your age, I was 15. And there's only one other thing to remember about this boat analogy. You get in a good boat, and it's great, and you discover you don't even want to go to Catalina. You want to stay in the boat. And it's great. And you pick up other pukes who are too dumb to row. What's the matter with you? Come on. And after a while, it gets so good that you say, hey, man, I'm sure glad I found this. You put down your oar, and it takes a while, but gradually the boat disappears, little by little. You don't even notice it. Some people are back in the water dead before they notice it. So there's really only two potentially dangerous times in sobriety. One is when you're first sober,
and the other is all the time after that. If you can just keep on your ball those two times, you're home free. But that's what AA is about. AA is not a become wonderful. No matter how hard you work this program, you will never rise above basic human being. Imperfect, emotional, some days cross, just other days just so goddamn wonderful you could replace maple syrup on waffles. That's why they say in AA, don't get too hungry or angry or lonely or tired. Not because they're bad things, but they are perspective disorders, perception disorders. When you're hungry, you stay all right. But everybody else gets a little stupid and slow is what they get. When you're angry, you just want a gun to educate them, you know. What's the matter with you? I'm going to tell you about love, you son of a bitch. Boom, boom. When you're lonely, that brings out the self-pity in everybody ever in the world. You know, just, I guess they're probably all at a party somewhere. Right? But they didn't tell me. And when... Oh, I don't drink coffee, son. Nobody likes a brown-nosed kid. He's learning about AA early. Here's where you extend the hand of friendship. Some fool bites it. Here. Thank you. Thank you. When you're tired, people really do things to you. And I don't know why. And I don't know how they know you're tired, but they know. I've mentioned this analogy before, but I watched it happen again last Monday. I had flown in late on Sunday night from somewhere, and I was tired, and I got up in the morning, I got in the freeway to go to work, and I had a big day, and I could just see it setting up there. See the guy in the blue station wagon? He's tired. Let's all cut that son of a bitch off. I tried to look rested. How do they know? How do they know? But I'm not hungry, angry, or lonely, or tired. I stay the same, but thank God you all shape up a little bit. That's all. That's the function of AA. It's sponsorship. It's steps. It's meetings. It's fellowship. It's taking actions. It is not to make you wonderful at all. It is to do something that is absolutely impossible that I know, that I can think of. It is to little by little upgrade your perception of reality. Everything else, little by little, shapes up. Not but, oh shit, oh shit, yeah. And if you don't roll, that's the way it goes down. That's all right. That's all right. Hey, he's going to hell. Yeah. Wasn't this way in the old days when we were sincere. Yeah. AA is the same as it has always been, I believe, since Dr. Bob and Bill sat in Akron, Ohio on June 10th, 1935, and decided to work with other people and to take actions that will help them recover from the necessity to have to drink. And that's what it boils down to, where the rubber meets the road. All the slickness, all the parties, all the fun, all the conventions, everything. They're all great, but they are adjunct to taking specific actions that will alter your perceptions and your emotions that will enable you to live in a world that is reasonably pleasant. That is why we gather meetings like this. Not, certainly not for the food. Oh. I didn't get any, that's why I mean I... Not that I could eat. No, we don't gather here because we need to be in this hot, smoky room. It's to reinforce again. It's to reinforce. No matter how it looks to you, baby, keep rowing. No matter how it looks to you today, whether you're above them or below them, keep rowing. And if you're new, row when you haven't got any oar. The purpose of a sponsor is to come by from time to time and say, hey, you got your oar upside down. Oh. Yeah. that in the last analysis, in my opinion, is the difference between a good treatment center and a bad treatment center. A bad treatment center releases people like me and says, now keep it together. You can make it from here. A good treatment center says, watch for those two pukes in an invisible boat. They'll be by soon. You better hop in because there ain't any other way you're going to make it. There's no other way that I know of that people like you and me can make it. To live in the world with some degree of dignity, to not have to drink, to feel strong, to feel little by little that the psychic holes are being filled up without ever having to drink to do it. Then it's worth everything it took. I'm glad I'm in Nebraska tonight. I'm glad that I really am glad because tomorrow afternoon, I won't be at the Super Bowl, but I'll be in Eau Claire, Wisconsin with my little old mother and father, and we'll be watching it on television. And as the camera pans over my seat in the warm sunlight, it's your fault, you old people. Then I'll roll home. I'm very glad that you had me here. I'm sorry that you couldn't have Joel, but perhaps another time. Thank you.